Well, some of us haven't had all day to sit at home and research these things, Haley.
Hello and welcome to another episode of WonkCast, the policy roundtable for policy perspectives of the George Washington University, Trachtenberg School of Public Policy, and Public Administration. Let's introduce the panel today.
I'm Adam Brooks.
I'm Elizabeth Moorhead.
I'm Shelley Starkey. I'm the special guest for today, and I'll be talking about behavioral health policy as it relates to the opioid epidemic.
Haley Dunn.
And I am Nathan Rupp. So our first segment is something we like to call Below the Fold, where each week we briefly talk about a policy issue in the news that may have been overlooked due to the bold headlines. So who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
As usual.
Haven't done that in a while,
actually. No, you haven't. It's true.
No. Get off my case. Anyway, so today I'm going to talk about the A-10. So the A-10 is a fixed-wing jet fighter aircraft that was specifically built to provide close air support. Basically, what happened was the House Armed Services Committee voted to approve spending $103 million on maintaining the A-10 squadrons. Now, there's a difference between appropriating the money and approving the money. Now that the money's been approved, it could be appropriated by the House Appropriations Committee. So it's not guaranteed that this money's going to be spent, but if this money is spent, a lot of these A-10 squadrons will be able to keep operating. Right now, a lot of the A-10s, they haven't had their wings replaced, and a lot of them are due to wear out in about 5 years. So when 2020 rolls around, or mid-2020 rolls around, a lot of these squadrons would have to start closing down. But this weapon system has a lot of political support. It's been very hard to get rid of because it's been instrumental in Afghanistan and Iraq. The A-10 is beloved by troops on the ground, it's beloved by the Air Force, it's beloved by Congress. And what makes this aircraft special is it's a flying tank, basically, right? So it'll fly in, it'll provide close air support, and it's very hard to shoot down. But the issue is, this aircraft was sort of outdated by the time the Afghan War and the Iraq War rolled around, right? You know, this was something that was fielded back in the 80s, right? So it's long overdue for a replacement.
Excellent.
I think I'll go next because mine is a little bit military related. And it also follows off with one of the below the folds that you did last week, Adam. This is about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, our U.S. Marine General Joseph Dunford, who recently visited our troops in Afghanistan this week to basically talk about the strategy that we have moving forward. You spoke about last week when General Mattis is talking about advancing the Afghanistan strategy and maybe deploying more troops and reassessing how we can better function in the region. Especially as a lot of the American public has forgotten that we're over there until we dropped a MOAB on them, you know. So while there's not a lot of information about what he was talking about necessarily, it is kind of the obvious next step in advancing this strategy. So maybe he's over there talking with our troops and assessing the situation and probably going to report back when he comes back to D.C. and say, this is how many troops we need, this is what we need them to do. So it's interesting to see how the war in Afghanistan is going to move forward.
I like it when people reference the things I say.
Yeah. You're so welcome.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, I'll go. So mine is a bit more local, and it's not necessarily government, but it is. So this week, there were three boys handcuffed at the National Mall by U.S. National Park police officers, and they were detained for selling water. And now, as an update, they've been offered a job by a program called HOPE, which is supposed to help, you know, just helping people excel. They're only high schoolers, so they're only like 17 and 18. So they're definitely in that next stage of like trying to figure out what to do, and selling water is fairly innocent, although illegal without a permit. They were handcuffed. And in response, the spokespeople chose to say that the incident was blown out of proportion. So they received some angry letters from council people saying that it wasn't blown out of proportion, that it was inappropriate. But I think it speaks to a larger narrative for the African-American community, especially when recently here we also had the DC missing girls, and they were all kidnapped, and the whole narrative was like, it's not really a spike, but the reality was the numbers showed like 12 people were kidnapped in 24 hours. So whether it's a spike or not, it's a problem. So to brush it off because it's African Americans just creates that narrative of it's okay to do. And I think that it creates the same narrative by saying it was blown out of proportion, by saying that about the National Mall. So I just want to highlight that it happened and say that changing the narrative and having people speak up and provide them with jobs shows a much better response than saying you're handcuffed for doing something illegal. So I will congratulate the people who gave them an opportunity to do something positive this summer.
Excellent. Haley?
So mine is an article that I was reading on CityLab about certain cities in Texas who are bringing the state to court over the controversial Senate Bill 4, SB 4, which was signed into law in May. So the cities and towns of Austin, Dallas, Houston, El Paso, San Antonio, and El Cenizo, along with the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, appeared in court earlier this week, so Monday, June 26th, and they sought a preliminary injunction against the bill. So basically, the law targets sanctuary cities and imposes sanctions on any jurisdictions that refuse to adhere to federal immigration laws, and it allows any law enforcement officer, including those who are employed by colleges or school districts, to ask any person for his or her immigration status at any time. And so U.S. Attorney General Sessions also filed a statement of interest in the case on the side of the state of Texas. And the law has faced considerable opposition, especially considering Texas has the second largest undocumented immigrant workforce in the country after California. So critics are concerned that this law could worsen conditions for these undocumented workers. And it also, to me, shows a divide that we can see in a lot of issues all across the country between conflicts between more liberal cities and more conservative rural areas. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, they're at the very early stages of the court process. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'll wrap up. I'm going to bring it back internationally now. And so I'm going to be talking about how just recently we have relabeled China as a sponsor of human trafficking. This is a big deal, one, because China was not marked in this list before. They've been moved to tier 3, which is the highest tier, puts them in line with countries like Iran and North Korea. So this is a big deal, partly because there are a lot of repercussions that come about when a country is labeled as a tier 3 human trafficker. Primarily, international aid and development aid will no longer be available. That is discretionary up to the president. So there have been cases where China has had issues with us in the past, and we have still continued to deal with them. So it is unclear whether or not this will actually be more than just an administrative posture towards China. But obviously they've responded rather quickly, actually, before the statement even came out. They've already rebutted it because they knew it was coming. So before Rex Tillerson made the release, the foreign secretary, Liu Kang, said that this is irresponsible, unacceptable, and basically, why is America forcing its ideas of law on us as a foreign nation? Like, they have no right to do this. And so that's my below the fold. Excellent. So we'll be right back with a deep dive into the opioid crisis. Welcome back. Shelley, take it away.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to be talking a little bit about behavioral health policy specifically attached to the opioid epidemic that we're seeing across the nation right now. For those of you that don't know, opioids are these powerful drugs that are often prescribed by doctors to treat acute and chronic pain disorders. Some opioids that you also find on the street are heroin and fentanyl. While fentanyl is often prescribed as these other ones are, like hydrocodone and methadone and oxycodone, fentanyl has been recently seeing an upsurge on the streets. It's been reproduced illegally, and fentanyl is actually 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, and that gives you an idea of how powerful these drugs are. So according to the data from the CDC, over 33,000 people died from opioid overdoses in 2015 alone, which is a huge number, and is honestly underestimate of the amount of deaths that this really could cause. So this is more than quadruple the number of these opioid deaths that we saw in 1999. is also mirrored closely by the amount of prescription opioids sold in the U.S., which also quadrupled since 1999.
So you've given us a bit of context of what opioids are. Can you give us a little bit of a background of how this happened?
Yeah, I don't know the specific date when it started becoming a problem. We've seen heroin in the streets as a problem for a long time, like since the 70s and 80s. But prescription opioids have become a problem recently as you've seen big pharma companies really pushing their products, like, hey, doctors, you need to prescribe this. And as we've seen a transition in the healthcare system towards patient satisfaction, where funding for doctors has become really tied closely to how satisfied their patients are. So whenever you have a patient that comes in presenting all this pain, then you're obviously going to prescribe them opioids so they're not feeling pain, and so they give you better ratings, and so you get more funding and all these different things. So we've seen this really a lot in recent years. It's probably been going on longer than it has been getting all this attention, but it definitely has been a more recent issue.
Especially since it started affecting white people.
Yeah, which really started in the 70s when Nixon declared this war on drugs, which is really interesting because later on, one of his close advisors, I'm going to butcher his name, but John Ehrlichman, he said, it came out like maybe 22 years after he allegedly said this, but he basically said that Nixon's war on drugs was a reaction to anti-war stuff and also a reaction just to African Americans existing as they were. And he said that this war on drugs was an attempt to incarcerate and basically break up these communities by making marijuana illegal and therefore incarcerating hippies that were anti-war, and then making like crack cocaine and heroin illegal, and then also incarcerating the black population. So you've seen over the years, it's really been this criminalizing drugs sort of effort. And just recently, it's become way more compassionate. And I believe, Adam, as you were saying, that it is a white face that's come across with this opioid epidemic, that as we've seen policymakers who have started to see people in their communities who look more like them, people that they can identify with, that we have started to see these more compassionate policies moving forward.
Before we get too far into that, where are the drugs coming from? Because this is not like a cocaine wave from Latin America, or weird synthetics coming from China. This is like a prescription drug that you can buy with a prescription, obviously. So where are people getting so much that they're dying? Like, where is this coming from?
Yeah, so there's been a huge overprescription trend just from doctors prescribing all these opioids. I think there's some startling statistic that there are enough prescription opioids to give every single man, woman, and child in America an opioid, like at the maximum dose, for a month or so right now in the United States. Yeah, and these prescriptions account for, I think, something like 50 to 60% of these opioid use disorders. Versus, you know, you've got like the street drugs like heroin and fentanyl that come later on down the road through addictions.
One thing I've always been worried about is because pain medication is so overprescribed, we never build up, you know, pain tolerance. I think pain tolerance is a real thing, right? There's only so many drugs you can take. There's only so much you can mitigate that pain. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you do build up a resistance to these things. So what happens when, you know, somebody gets a minor injury, is prescribed pain medication, builds up a resistance to it.
Well, that also brings up, and I don't know, Shelley, if this is too much of a medical question, but, you know, what kind of alternatives are there for people who, you know, to opioid prescriptions, for people who have really bad chronic pain issues? Or, you know, I know people who can't take any kind of pain medication because of past addiction issues. And, like, what other alternatives are there if we're cutting down on, you know, opioid prescriptions, besides just, as Adam's mom told him to, having a spoonful of cement to harden up? What other policies or what other procedures are there?
Yeah, I think that does dive a little bit more into the medical stuff that I am familiar with, but there definitely are, like, it's referenced in the literature that there are other effective means to addressing these pain issues. So whereas chronic pain, they have to deal with this in the long term, right? So they have to come up with long-term ways to deal with it, and opioids are not the answer. So going back to your question, Nathan, about where these deaths are coming from, the way that opioids work, you start out at a lower dosage and it deals with your pain. And then as the pain gets worse or as it gets longer, you build up a resistance to these different drugs. So you start having to take more and more to get the same effect. And so what happens is if you get addicted and then you go into short-term treatment, which is one of the many problems, is that our treatment system is not built to be long-term treatment. It's more short-term. So you go to a short-term treatment facility and you get clean, as they say, or you become abstinent to these drugs. And then you go back and you go back to using, and you take the dose that you were used to before you went to the short-term treatment facility, and you overdose because your body isn't used to it anymore. So that's where a lot of these deaths are coming from, is the lack of long-term treatment supports.
I think the big problem is with the opioid epidemic is not that suddenly all these people are like, yeah, let's get into heroin. It's, you know, and I mean, part of that is also like the demographics of people who are affected. Like most of the people are between like the ages of 45 and 60, which is maybe not what some people would expect if you're just thinking about like recreational street use of the drug. But like if you're prescribed a medication and your body builds up a tolerance, I feel like it's not like you're like taking a jump off a cliff. It's like you're slowly rolling down a hill and you don't notice until it's too late. Someone would be like, oh yeah, but that won't happen to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to go out and do heroin.
My understanding of it is that people turn to heroin after they use this pain medication because the heroin's cheaper.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say the money thing too.
Yeah, absolutely. So heroin and fentanyl are a lot cheaper to find, and they're easier to find on the streets rather than trying to doctor shop and try to find the different prescriptions. You know, if you can just buy it off of somebody, then it's easier to sustain your habit that way.
Mm-hmm. And are they worse? Is, like, there levels to these opioids? Like, is it worse to do?
Is the heroin the healthier option?
Is the heroin an unhealthier option since it's cheaper? Like, you know, crack is worse than cocaine. Mm-hmm. So
I think that heroin and fentanyl are probably a lot stronger.
I mean, like I said, fentanyl even
function on a daily basis mm-hmm. while taking opioid pain prescriptions.
Well, like I said, fentanyl, even in the prescribed form, is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, mm-hmm. which is something that everybody knows about. You know, morphine is another opioid pain management.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying, I think, like, heroin and fentanyl are probably a lot worse than, like, oxycodone would be.
Yeah. And it's dangerous because you can get more for the same amount of money.
You just got to find a reputable drug dealer, and then you're good.
One that's regulated. A regulated drug dealer.
Right.
Speaking of regulated drug dealers. Yeah, so speaking of regulated drug dealers, what is the attitude of the pharmaceutical industry that was really responsible for this whole epidemic? What has been their response to this wave of bad publicity, which is not good for the bottom line, obviously, which is the only reason they'll actually change as well. So what has their response been, or as well as what's been the government response?
So I honestly don't know a lot about the actual pharmaceutical companies and their response. I do know a bit about the public policy response. So some of the things that we've been seeing, like I mentioned earlier about the war on drugs, was really about crime and punishment, you know, about incarcerating these horrible drug users. Now that we've seen a white face put to it, and we've seen people that look a lot like policymakers and their friends, we've seen a much more compassionate response. So you've seen public policy decisions pushed through. Like in 2016, we had two bills recently passed under President Obama. We've got the 21st Century Cures Act, as well as CARA, or the Comprehensive Addictions and Recovery Act, which were both like huge funding packages. So CARA, obviously the Comprehensive Addictions and Recovery Act, was funding specifically approved for addictions response. And then you've got the 21st Century Cures Act, which was pushed through for a lot of different medical funding, but also included some funds specifically for the opioid epidemic. Yeah, so instead of, as we've seen historically, like lock them up and throw away the key kind of policies, these policies push forward funding for different treatment initiatives, different prevention initiatives. Instead of putting people into the criminal justice system, they're trying to figure out how to divert these people. So instead of pushing money towards, you know, law enforcement and trying to get them to be locked up, it's pushing them forward, pushing the money towards trying to get them out of the criminal justice system and back as productive members of society.
I would also like to point out that it's not just a white face, it's a middle class face too.
Yes.
Because we're all familiar with the white trash jokes, trailer trash.
So
jokes,
I was like, right? Is it a middle class thing as far as like class reference, where what's like the, I don't say income bracket breakdown, but like what are we talking here?
Yeah, so we've seen more, disproportionately, obviously, white people are being affected more than different minorities. And the income bracket is a lot higher than it has been for different things. So I think you're referencing things like the meth epidemic that we've talked about.
Exactly.
Which also elicited a very crime and punishment kind of response. Like, lock them up and throw away the key, which is unfortunate.
Well, I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, how many people have grown up with a relative who has an addiction problem? Like, my family... There's a ton of people with addiction problems. Like, we've had alcoholism, we've had... I had an aunt who was addicted to crack. I mean, it's not... It was very surprising to me when it started to become a big thing, because I was like, well, yeah, this has been a problem for, like, decades. I mean, why are we just talking about it now?
Well, it's a problem when you see, like, Governor Chris Christie, right? Mm-hmm. He always references his friend from law school who had it all. He had a beautiful wife and beautiful children, and they were all geniuses. But then his friend succumbed to an opioid addiction, right? And he passed away because of this unfortunate circumstance.
I mean, I definitely feel, as far as the crack epidemic goes and how it relates, I just think it's interesting. That's a totally different narrative, but it's also different in how it was introduced into the community,
yes.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And around the crack epidemic, there was so much... rumor, I'll say, with air quotes, that it was introduced by the government into the African-American communities. So I think that now, I think that was more of a targeted narrative, and now that this is more of a, like, it shows how it can spread in a greater, like, you can try and introduce it just to, it can target one population, but you can't avoid it from being something that is bigger than just one population.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. So the narrative of this really has been it's sweeping, it's this crisis. How has this narrative of this, like, opioid crisis been beneficial or harmful to potential policy treatments?
Yeah, so similar to what you're saying about the source of this epidemic, this is very different in that a lot of it has been introduced through our healthcare system, right? Like, our doctors are complicit in starting this epidemic. And so therefore, it's pretty easy to get them on board with treating it. Like, hey, you guys messed up and there's all these problems, let's fix it. So I think that we've seen a lot of policies moving forward that have been informed by the people that have been really deeply entrenched in it.
Okay, so I have a question about this.
Yes.
So that makes me wonder, so we have this tough on crime stance coming up again. So let's say people started using marijuana as a replacement. Do you think that would make it so this administration would say, like, never mind, like, let's not even really focus on the opioid epidemic? Because let's say you're like, okay, we'll use marijuana. But then if you're letting people use marijuana for that, can you really have all these people jailed for selling marijuana? All these people are locked up for it. So do you think it would prevent or stall just because we have this tough on crime stance kind of coming back up? And you can't really say, like, they get out of jail free, but these people stay in jail.
Well, I wonder if you could have more of a distinction. I mean, you could still have it medical marijuana versus recreational in that way. Like, you could expand, like, the types of disorders and methods that medical marijuana is prescribed for. Medical marijuana often, like, is formulated differently than what you'd use to get, you know, more of like a head high anyway, which would be more effective for pain management. I mean, I don't really see this administration going for expanded medical marijuana either, but that could be kind of more of a middle ground if people don't want to just go for legalizing more recreational uses or recreational marijuana, even if people are going to use it for self-medication.
Yeah, I don't think we can expect nuance from Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions.
No, we cannot.
But I don't know if this is kind of tangential, but I was doing a project about the heroin epidemic in my home city, Massachusetts, and I was looking into safe injection sites, and I was wondering if you guys had opinions on the effectiveness of that in terms of preventing overdose deaths.
I think that safe injection sites are further down the road after we get these other programs figured out. Like in other countries, like in the Netherlands, where they've legalized all these different drugs and they have, you know, they've seen these things that are working, they've been able to implement these safe injection sites, but we're not anywhere close to that. I think that's way down the road after we figure these other things out.
It would be nice if the federal government sort of got out of the way. Republican talking point. it would be nice if the federal government got out of the way and allowed the states and localities to experiment with policy ideas and treatment ideas. That is how you take advantage of a federal system, which we live under, letting the states and localities experiment and try new things, not having a blanket policy.
And I think that also speaks to, like, the fact that it affects different people. So it's like, it's easy to ignore if it's not in your state, but then in some states it's so big, so allowing them to be the states to experiment would be really helpful, because it's easy to ignore if you're not in those states.
So this actually raises a great point, which I'd like to end on. Do you think the larger problem here is a systemic drug issue, or more of a attitude towards drug addiction? Which of these do you think is more harmful to the American public?
Well, I think there's problems on both sides. You know, you've got this idea in the American public that addictions are a moral failing instead of a medical issue, you know, like this reoccurring system in your brain that's telling you you have to keep using these different drugs. But then there's also a huge federal issue, and I mean, even on the state level, of not enough access to treatment, not enough prevention programs, which is just we're gonna see that increase. You guys talk about these letting the states experiment, but they're not gonna have any wiggle room if the administration moves forward with the healthcare policy that they're trying to push right now.
All right, excellent. When we come back, spin this. Welcome back. We are now going to jump into our final segment, Spin This, where our panel briefly discusses a topic that has been assigned to them by our randomized wheel, and they give us their opinion. The topics for this week are the Supreme Court's summer docket, how special are the special elections, private security for elected officials, the failed tax policy of Kansas, and last but not least, red lines in Syria. So who would like to go first?
I would.
Excellent. Haley, let's get this show on the road. You have failed tax policy in Kansas.
Cool beans. So I was reading a couple articles about this because I'd vaguely heard about it, but wasn't paying attention because I just thought it was stupid. And I still don't think it was a good policy. I think, like, part of the problem, it seems to be, like, they pursued, like, extreme tax cuts but did not cut back on government expenditures. So, of course, they, like, drove their economy, like, pretty far into debt. And I think, like, part of the biggest problem that they were having was with the exemption for the pass-through entities, which are basically businesses that pay their taxes through the individual income tax code rather than the corporate tax code. And by allowing people to do that, they basically drastically reduced the tax revenue that they'd otherwise be getting at the corporate tax rate. I think, you know, things like that could be offset if either the government had cut back on expenditures or, you know, the economy had been stimulated enough to make up for it, which there's really not a lot of evidence for. So there's really not a lot of evidence that this experiment went well at all. Mm-mm. And so it's going to be interesting. He actually, Sam Brownback, has the worst approval rating besides Chris Christie among governors at the moment. So he's not doing so well. And his Republican-led legislature basically overruled his veto and reinstated, like, I think $1.2 billion in taxes. So it's really interesting to see this kind of, like, extreme experiment with supply-side economics that really didn't do at all what was intended or promised. And, you know, as someone who generally isn't a huge fan of supply-side economic policies, it gives me great cheer. And I hope that it kind of serves as an example that, you know, tax policies that extreme are unlikely to be very beneficial.
The scary thing is, though, that the same advisors that, like, kind of helped formulate this for Kansas are trying to help formulate the Trump administration's tax policy. Side note.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. All right. That was excellent. Who's next?
I'll go next.
Red lines in Syria.
Oh, yes. Perfect.
Perfect.
Well, I heard that the Trump administration issued a statement that said that they would, that the Syrian regime would suffer, you know, severe consequences if it used chemical attack. or if it conducted another chemical attack. This is in light of, apparently they received intelligence that they were planning on doing it. So if they do use another chemical weapon, I think that we should respond. And I think the response should be even more substantial than the last one was. Because clearly, they didn't get the message the first time. Using chemical weapons is inappropriate. Even by Assad standards, using chemical weapons is inappropriate. And we have to make it clear that it's inappropriate. And the only way to do that is to inflict consequences on the Assad regime. This is sort of why we also shot down that Syrian aircraft when it attacked our allies on the ground, because we had to send a message. The only thing that the Assad regime and the Russians respond to is the use of force, and we need to use force where it's appropriate, and this is a situation where it would be appropriate.
All right, excellent. Who's next?
I can go.
All right. Private security for elected officials.
So the reason that we're talking about private security for elected officials recently is because of the recent unfortunate shooting of Majority Whip Steve Scalise at a congressional baseball game practice. So now House representatives and senators alike are kind of freaking out about growing tensions in America and their personal safety. You know, whenever they're at official events, they've got Capitol security around them, but people that are lower down the food chain don't always have somebody with them. So policymakers are kind of watching their own back here and trying to push legislation to protect themselves and get private security. So I personally think that maybe it's just a knee-jerk reaction to somebody in their midst getting hurt. As a policy nerd myself, I think it's too small of a sample size to see if it's to see if it's really something that they need to be concerned about. I think the huge narrative right now is that there's all this partisan divide and that there's these growing tensions, and so that's going to lead to people getting hurt. But yeah, I think it's too small of a sample size, and maybe there is a real threat and maybe there's not a real threat. I personally just think it's interesting that they can move something, a bipartisan bill, through Congress so quickly when it deals with their own personal security, but they haven't really moved a lot of stuff dealing with, you know, the Americans' public security.
Excellent. That was a nice touch at the end. So, Elizabeth, you are second to last, so you can have a choice between the Supreme Court's summer docket and how special are special elections.
I'll take the special elections.
Go for it.
So I think most of the special elections coverage I was seeing was in Georgia. I feel like that got the most attention by the media. And the main thing I was seeing was just the celebration of, like, these white suburban women were, like, really, like, pushing for the Democrat to win. And it was, like, so celebrated. And then the Democrat lost. And Democrats all over lost. So I think it just kind of says that, once again, I just feel like it's the narrative of, like, because white women voted for Trump and that kind of got pushed, I feel like we kind of turned the focus to, like, now they're, like, trying to push for the Democratic Party, and it was very celebrated. But I think it speaks to the fact that the Democratic agenda and the narrative and what they're saying needs to change, because it's not really resonating with people. And it's not enough just to say, like, look, we have people out here who didn't vote for Trump, who you thought voted for Trump, and that's not enough. It doesn't connect to people, and it doesn't speak to, like, policy and actual things that would impact people. It's not just enough to say, like, we have people on our side. I think we need to actually talk about what is happening and what needs to happen and what voting for a Democrat really means, not just, like, we have more people voting for Democrats.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I'll go last with the Supreme Court's summer docket. I'm also going to mix in some of the things they've got coming up as well. But the big things they've recently closed up on was a case on copyrights and potentially inflammatory words. In this case, it is an Asian band called The Slants. They won the case. They are now now you're allowed to copyright things that could be potentially inflammatory. The Supreme Court has recently decided they will hear issues on the travel ban. They reinstated part of it, and then they'll be hearing the rest of it later. Also, a big thing they'll be hearing soon is on religious freedom, as they like to call it. And what that is a case particularly around a cake maker who did not want to make a cake for a same-sex wedding. I'm interested in seeing how this is all going to go, particularly since we may be losing a Supreme Court justice in the coming weeks.
Don't say it.
I just did. Anyway, Kennedy might leave.
Might retire.
Well, I heard that it was just a rumor.
It is a rumor, but rumors start somewhere.
Yeah, well, let's have him hang in there a bit longer.
They start from facts.
He's only 82. He can make it 4 more years.
Yeah, right? On that note, thank you for listening, and we will be back in a week. Goodbye. Everyone say goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.
This show is edited by Nathan Rupp, produced by Haley Dunn, and music by Pelly Gunther.